Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we have a special guest with us. We have Maria Fix Altieri, renowned psychic, and she's been on our show before several times. And she's a good friend of mine. And tonight we're going to be discussing mysticism. But Maria has stated that she has been getting a lot of her clients and a lot of people are calling her, and they're going through a very difficult time. And she wanted to enlighten them with a work that inspired her, but inspired so many people over hundreds of years. And it's called the Dark Night of the Soul, which was written by mystic St. John of the Cross and or San Juan de la Cruz, and a Spanish mystic, a Catholic mystic. And we're going to discuss that. If anybody would like to go to the website that I found here, it's called Dark Night of the Soul, actually. But let's see if they're... index the works, collect the works of St. John of the Cross, this is it's really quite a remarkable work. If you go to it, you'll see you might be able to follow through some of what we're going to be talking about tonight. And Maria is on the line, and I'll put her on. Good evening, Maria.
Hello, Leo. How are you this evening?
Very good. A little warm here tonight, but, you know, we're getting through it. The Dark Night of the Soul, and we're looking forward to talking about it.
Interesting work.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, I was able to review it before we came on tonight, and it's a fascinating work, and it's immortal, because I know that you know, the Dark Night of the Soul is many people have heard of it or know of it. They probably don't know where it came from or where it was derived from, but we hope to tell them tonight that it was from St. John of the Cross.
He's a Spanish mystic. They called him San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross. And basically, his work is man's instinctive search for reality. And I know it says the dark night of the soul, which it sounds like it's in the evil aspect of the soul. But basically, it's the awakening of the soul that he works with.
Right. I noticed that, it was interesting. I was able to read it earlier, and I found that there are certain things I don't know if I fully agree with him on it, because he was a Catholic mystic, and of course from the 15th century. But the amazing thing that what I've always found difficult, Maria, to, and I know you have it, I know anybody who lives in this dimension, as a human being, can't really break away from the sensuality aspect of our lives, you know. And I mean, everything around us is there to attract us, you know. Nature, flowers, the trees, sun, sky. Everything is there to aid us, and as he mentioned, it's like in the beginning of that work, it's like he talks about us being babies, okay, babies, and being caressed and weaned and
coddled. Basically coddled. Much of his work described how we're driven by the what you would call the exoteric, the outside world, by our objective aspects on what we see.
Right.
Basically, much of his message, I don't agree with all of it, but maybe I don't understand all of it either. I don't.
I'm like that myself. As I read it, I found myself understanding what he's saying, going through these different stages. And of course, he says that the three things that fight us are the world, the devil, and fear. All right, and yeah, you know, definitely. And those are the stages that keep knocking us or pulling us or pushing us off the path, you know.
Well,
bringing us back.
The book assumes that man has three natures or parts, of which the highest, he says, is the first, which is essentially the spiritual. The second nature, he says, is the psychic or belonging to the sphere of the soul. The third, he says, is material or bodily or corporal, relating to the realm of the body. So when we're talking threefold, exactly what you said, I'm saying the same thing in a different language. So the threefold division is religions, philosophies of the past, and what he basically is saying, that in modern times, to understand the nature of the universe or God, and as you said, he was Christian, but yet he doesn't stick to one particular deed or creed when you read his works, because he talks about many religions. But basically what he's saying is that there's man nowadays, modern man, takes the approach of knowledge more in a materialistic way than a natural way. And he's saying that the outside world basically forces upon us the exterior factors. That's where we get confused and we don't go to our own nature.
And I think it's important, too, to note that in the beginning, especially in this particular one I'm reading, this translation, the translator states that it's important to remember that St. John was actually in a state of
consciousness.
He was virtually unconscious, and not so much as we know it, but he was out of body. He was channeling this. Writing this from a much higher level of consciousness than we would have expected. In fact, he says that at the beginning of this, in the book itself, he says that he left his home at night and found himself, reclined in the Beloved. It says, "In all season I abandoned myself, leaving my cares forgotten among the lilies." So in other words, as he began this, as he started to experience this knowledge that came to him, he was actually oblivious. He was lost in oblivion, okay, when this came to him. He was having a mystical experience. And then this came to him, explaining how we go through the dark night of the soul. But I'm sorry, I didn't want to get off on...
I'm listening, because... the thought that just came to my mind is mysticism is actually, again, another language of psychism, where he existed, as you say, in another level of consciousness. And when you say channeling, we're basically, his work is about oneness, the reality that we all have the ability to channel. And a lot of his work talks about discipline in reaching the state that he was in, so that we can become aware that we don't allow the outside world to interfere. Now, again, he uses that triad as the outside world being what you were saying, even psychic senses. The psychic is a very, very powerful organism, and which he lived beyond even that psychic realm, which they would call the mystic realm.
Right, and he says when he starts this, I'll just mention it. It says the stanzas of the soul. It says, on a dark night, kindled in love with yearnings, well, happy chance. He said, I went forth without being observed. My house now being now at rest. And what he's saying there was that he went out in the dark night unafraid, basically, because his house was at, meaning he was at rest, his body was at rest, his spirit, his sensual being was at rest in the state that he had already gone through the dark night, and this is what happened. And then in the darkness and secure by the secret ladder, because I disguised, oh happy chance, in darkness and in concealment, my house being at rest again, it says, and in the happy night in secret, when none saw me, nor I beheld aught, without light or guide, save that which burned in my heart. This light guided me more surely than the light of noonday to the place where he was waiting for me, and a place where none appeared. And the night guided him, and O night, more lovely than the dawn, O night, but joined beloved with lover, and lover transformed into beloved. All right, and it almost sounds like a rendezvous, you know, but in essence, what it was his rendezvous with God, all right, and his entering this perfect state of bliss, all right, and that he took so long to get there, and this is how, and the book explains how he was able to achieve that state, you know, going through the dark night of the soul, and the only thing that I disagree with him on really is in the basic self-flagellation. That he seems to go through, which is really a kind of a Catholic thing that was brought upon by so many of these people back then, was this. And he talks about this as part of the
transgression, yeah.
Change, yeah.
Transition.
Right, the self-hating.
And part of, if I may, in much of his other work, he actually speaks that you don't need to suffer to receive that. But in the very early days, that's where he says that the soul is immature, or we're still immature. And therefore, he says the soul must lead the body. And he says that the suffering that comes to us is because man could be wrong in certain ideas of what they believe God to be or their soul to be. And he goes on to say that in particular situations, the individual must meditate with calmness to get beyond that self-flagellation, as you said, or self-suffering. Because he truly believes that we don't have to suffer to receive, and that's where he brings in the aspect that our soul or ourselves are not mature yet. We're still basically infants in the aspect of the growth of the soul, or the wanting and the knowing of the truth. An individual cannot live by himself alone. He needs people around him. So there's this dichotomy that goes on that says, without individuals around you, how do you reach that? And yet he himself as a mystic is living in almost a, I don't want to say a departed state, but in an evolved state of being. But he goes on to say that we need discipline. Actually, I'm gonna read a little piece from a pamphlet I have from some of his work here, and it says, that discipline upon our external life comes to us largely in the form of our responsibilities. The average person becomes involved in situations in which he must assume a certain burden. this is where some people in the creeds or the religions believe that they had to hurt themselves with that burden in order to receive. Do you understand what I'm saying?
And I see it here more. He said that a number of times in this, and he went through the different phases too. The different sins, if you will, or the different things that we do as we go through this dark night of the soul, false pride and false. False confession, all these falsehoods that we deal with in order to preserve our own ego, if you will, or our preserve, to show that we're not as bad as we are, you know, or as we,
Books of redemption, you know, ultimately, every action of man must be regarded as being redeemed. I'm reading another piece here. It says, the individual living long enough without discipline becomes so helplessly involved in an undisciplined career, and that discipline becomes necessary to him. Now, that discipline could be work, could be the road of trial and error, consisting of so much trial and so much error that the entire advancement of humanity becomes in danger because we're working with the outside. Now, what I believe he's attempting to portray is that we're living in a world of an illusion and that the inner world is actually the world. So on the outside, we do these burdens, we do these sufferings. He went through that whole dark side of the not knowing till he put discipline and relaxed his mind or brought himself to a point of another level of consciousness so that he can educate, redeem, and enlighten his intentions before he even moves in a certain direction.
Right. I understand what you're saying, yeah.
As far as his creeds go and aspects of that, he has an awareness that every person must be responsible for every action and every thought process that he goes through. Now, being a mystic and him pointing out and saying that he left what appears to be the dark and met with, as you called it, the rendezvous with God, or let's say his higher self, or aspects of the reality of oneness, of the total aspect of the universe. You can call it God, you can call it cosmic law, but of course he was, as you said, he was brought up with a Catholic discipline in a sense.
Right. I noticed here too, I just I was going through this again, and this kind of explains what we were saying, but it says, but neither from these imperfections, and he talks about the different imperfections of people, priding their work and priding this and priding that, and showing that they do good charity work or whatever, and they take great satisfaction in the fact that they are doing such good works, all right? But it says, but neither from these imperfections nor from those others can the soul be perfectly purified until God brings it into the passive purgation of that dark night, whereof we shall speak presently. It befits the soul, however, to contrive to labor in so far as it can on its own account, and to end that it may purge and perfect itself, and thus may merit being taken by God into that divine care, wherein it becomes healed of all things that it was unable of itself to cure. Because however greatly the soul itself labors, it cannot actively purify itself, so as to be in the least degree prepared for the divine union of perfection of love. If God takes not its hand and purges it not in that dark fire, in the way and manner that we have to describe. And in other words, if we don't go, if he doesn't put us through this purge, then of pain and suffering and so on, then we still don't understand the humility and discipline that we must have, okay, in order to reach a perfect union with God. And I have a feeling that that's very true to some extent, which would of course explain why everybody suffers so, and through all of these different maladies, through illness or through failures or through, you know, marriages or whatever, that, you know, divorces or whatever, or deaths, whatever the grief may be, I guess we have to get there. We find ourselves, if we can survive it, we eventually find ourselves and we become one with the divine, you know, one with God.
I don't feel, in fact, I have a conviction that we're never separate from the soul, cosmic mind, God, universal laws. There is no separation. There is illusion that we are in this physical body and the soul is basically, I want to say, trapped, or let's say our body is almost like the casing of a seed, in a sense, and the soul is deep within inside. And when he says the dark night of the soul, it just reminds me of the seed being embedded into the earth till it pops through and then blossoms. Now, he says over here, the autonomy of existence is what remains that needs for the soul to grow. And it says, and it is the growing up of the soul, its maturing, and its acceptance of the peculiar responsibilities of its own nature. Now, what I believe he's attempting to say is that we don't understand the nature of our soul. Just because we go inside doesn't necessarily mean the answers are in there. If we have confusion on the outside, we may even have confusion on the inside. Where he himself said that all the suffering, you suffer to the point where when someone is going through that, where do they look? They look to God or a higher entity or whatever word you choose to use as far as a divine being with our guidance. And what he's saying is that as we suffer, we're creating this suffering because we could be wrong with the understanding. What we call suffering is a constant reminder to us of our own insufficiencies. That's the way I believe he's trying to say. Suffering is like the challenge of reality constantly besetting us. The moment the individual is greater than his problem, he can no longer suffer from it. And then it's no longer the source of negativity. And you can overcome all the situations. Now, he has done this in his own consciousness. He recognized that he was greater than any of those problems by going through that. And I had mentioned this once before, and he says it's because the universe imposes discipline upon that which does not discipline itself. The average person seems to have a greater memory of the sorrows and the difficulties, and that's really not supposed to be natural for divine bliss or nirvana or meeting with what you would call the creator or God or the higher realms of consciousness. I truly know that there is no separation in reality, in the real reality of who we are. The separation is going through, as you said, fighting the ego, fighting the outside world, the sensitivities we have, the love for another person. In fact, there was some work I read that he wrote that said that we shouldn't be affectionate, and I found that, like, disconcerting to me. I think affection is part of love, but it's a self-love. It's a love for another person. So actually, since we're all one, when he's talking about affection, he's talking about we're loving ourselves in a physicality rather than a soul level.
I agree. And, you know, I was reading through some of this again, and, you know, and he lists the different imperfections that we encounter within ourselves, and there are a number of them. One is imperfections with respect to the sin of wrath, okay, being angry at other people and being angry with the world and trying to overcome that anger.
Yeah, peril. That creates peril. That creates poison in the body.
Right. And then he has another, which is the imperfections with respect to spiritual gluttony, right? And this one is great because this one really.
Yeah, you can have a spiritual ego.
Absolutely,
Yes.
He really encompasses a lot with this, but with that particular one, spiritual gluttony. But the last paragraph kind of sums it up pretty well. These persons have many other imperfections which arise hence, of which in time the Lord heals them by means of temptations, aridities, and other trials, all of which are part of the dark night. All these I will not treat further here, lest they're too lengthy. I will also say that spiritual temperance and sobriety lead to another and very different temper, which is that of mortification, fear, and submission in all things. If must become clear that the perfections and worth of things consist not in multitude and in the pleasantness of one's actions, but in being able to deny oneself in them. Thus, such persons must endeavor to encompass in so far as they may until God is pleased to purify them indeed by bringing them into the dark night to arrive at which I am hastening on my account of these imperfections. But he talks about how they... people believe that people believe that by pleasing themselves, they're pleasing God.
Okay? Exactly.
And such persons expend all their effort in seeking spiritual pleasure and consolation, and they never tire thereof of reading books, and they begin now on one meditation, now on another, and in their pursuit of this pleasure, which they desire to experience in the things of God. But God very justly, wisely, and lovingly denies it to them, for otherwise this spiritual gluttony and inordinate appetite would breed innumerable evils. It is therefore very fitting that they should enter into the dark night, whereof we shall speak, that they may be purged from this childlessness, which is... That, you know, that the child, the sense of self-gratification, you know, and seeking but not finding, just kind of, you know, it's like eating half a candy and throwing, you know, kids say, I don't like, I'm full, and throwing it away, you know.
Well, nobody likes discipline and no one likes to be wrong. But it reminds me of rapture when every new millennium comes around, or when they talk the time of rapture. These individuals believed that it was going to be the end of the world, so they took all their gold and melted it down into crosses and things and stood on the hill, and they thought it was going to be the end of the world, and so they were going to gratify themselves by making religious icons so that God would be pleased with this, but yet the end of the world didn't come, and it seems to be like not a watered down, but another way of looking at individuals as far as rapture. As long as I'm good to me and I'm good to another person, then I should get through the gates of heaven, or God should just say, yes, please, come sit wherever you want. It's beautiful here. But there's labor involved. If truth were understood and actually applied to a problem, it will result in the complete disintegration of the problem. The thing is, people want to know what is the truth. We're guided by so many disciplines that are out there. Or let's say the real discipline should be the inward seeking and watching the thought processes that we do have. Discipline is so vital and necessary. And when I use the word discipline, it's just like when you want to discipline a child. As much as you want to give the child everything they want, like you said, you're only getting half the candy bar. Sometimes that child will resent that discipline, resent the parent, but at the same time, the parent knows that you're not going to give a six-year-old the keys to the car to go drive because it would be dangerous. So I believe what he's saying is that we can't just walk into it because we think we can do it like a six-year-old driving a car. And he's saying that our soul or the understanding of our growth and God, where our soul is really just maturing. And the idea that we're denied, just like you would deny the child the keys to the car, then we start resenting and saying, well, maybe God doesn't exist. Or maybe I'm in the wrong job. And what he's saying is instead of looking to the outside world for the answers, attempt, again, I'm using the word discipline very redundantly, and forgive me for that, but I feel that much of his work is about if there's truth in the belief that man sometimes, somewhere, can find some sort of relief from the pressures of his own nature, where are you going to start? You're going to start inside. You're going to start inside. And we've been fed so much from academia, from religions, from parental guidance. And Saint John over here truly said that nothing out there is going to really help us until we go inside. And if we're denied something, it's because perhaps we were wrong with an idea.
Yeah, I understand. And there's other areas which are kind of interesting that create problems for us in this dark night of the soul. It's of imperfections with respect to spiritual envy and sloth. That's actually chapter 7 of his first book. Spiritual envy and sloth. And I find that to be interesting because, it says, with respect to two vices, with respect likewise to the other two vices, which are spiritual envy and sloth,
mm-hmm.
These beginners, and he's saying beginners through the darkness, fail not to have many imperfections. But with respect to envy, many of them are wont to experience movements of displeasure at the spiritual good of others, which causes them to assert a certain sensible grief at being outstripped upon this road, so that they would prefer not to hear others praised, for they become displeased at others' virtues, and sometimes they cannot refrain from contradicting what is in praise of them. They're appreciating it as far as they can, and their annoyance thereat grows, because the same is not said of them. And I've seen this so many times before.
All right. I have one word for that. It's called malice.
It's malice, yeah. But he says it's the envy, and that envy happens so frequently. And there are people out there who have reached certain levels of consciousness or awareness that they do incredibly good works, lead organizations and heal with faith and so on and so forth.
Even Teresa had doubts at the end,
What's that?
Saint Teresa, she even had doubts at the end.
But she was extremely envied by many people too.
And she had her own doubts about if the work that she did would truly bring her to what she understood God to be. Now, our great problem is the fear that we will be betrayed from within ourselves, or perhaps that we're betraying ourselves now and we don't even know it by our own understandings or misunderstanding.
Oh, yeah. And it says, it's interesting, it says, All this is clean, contrary to charity, which, as St. Paul says, rejoices in goodness. If charity has an envy, it is a holy envy, comprising grief at not having the virtues of others, yet also joy because others have them, and delight when others outstrip us in the service of God, wherein we ourselves are so remiss. So in other words, it's like, where, you know, some people, are, like, for instance, myself, I'm extremely grateful that somebody like Mother Teresa or Mandela or Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. or, you know,
Buddha or the great beings, all of them.
Yeah, have reached certain levels of faith and evolved consciousness that they can do this stuff, you know what I mean? And have this for them and raise mankind to a higher level of enlightenment through their work. But, you know, they had a lot of cynics and a lot of people who hated them because of this and would say, you know, would try to find fault with them. And they would find plenty of fault with themselves. But at the same time, these works were thrust upon them and they got in the middle of that, and they took it on their shoulders and became great leaders and great humanitarians. And I don't think I envy them, except that I, because they suffered tremendously, and many of them were assassinated, you know. But I can say that I admired them, and I think maybe that's what holy envy is admiration for people like that. What do you think?
Well,
there are people who do not like them because of that. But.
The difficulty here, the real difficulty here is that they can say all this, but are they peaceful and happy within themselves? If they're not, they're going to see someone else. That's where the envy comes in. That if individuals that are doing this charity work or the work for the good of humanity, for the good of community.
Right.
I mean, in the Agni Yoga works, we talked about community.
Right.
And idea of taking that which you know to rise or help raise humanity. But there are individuals now who say, well, you know, thou cannot get there unless it goes through me or my teaching or this or that. He
right.
breaks away from the concept that all these other individuals or teachers or whatever is out there, it exists, but yet until one is peaceful, both in himself and in his environment, and true religion really has nothing to do with the church. It's a doorway leading to another world of experience. But man has to open the door with his own strength and courage, his own ability, and pass through the suffering, or let's say testing, that leads the door to integrity to his own soul. Because what he's saying is that he found his soul, or he found what he understood God to be, and his saintlyhood and all of this. But again, the integrity must be within your own soul. These other individuals, when you say the envy they have of people that do good, is only because they're restless within themselves.
Yeah, like for instance, there's so many examples of people that do so much good work, it's easy to be, to say, well, God bless them, you know, they're doing good work, but there are others that would, you know, not be happy about it and try to find some fault with it because it is good work and they're not capable of doing it themselves, you know.
I think we should all get rid of our fault-finding list.
Because
as long as we find fault in another human being, no matter what it is in this outside world, that fault is going to come back at us, and in that sense, we're not raising our consciousness at all. We may not like the opinions of other people or even the way they live their life or the politics behind it and things of that nature, but yet each journey is for each individual within their own understanding. where it constitutes the journey of the soul. And that journey of the soul is perhaps what he calls the breaking away from, maybe he doesn't say it in those words, but not paying attention to the do-gooders. Like, I did so good that their spiritual ego actually blocks them from getting there.
Right, and he mentions that in this particular work. But the funny thing, this thing I think you'll find funny too, is we all do this. I do it, and it's with respect to spiritual sloth. Beginners are apt to be irked by the things that are most spiritual, from which they flee because these things are incompatible with sensual pleasure. For as they are so much accustomed to sweetness and spiritual things, they are wearied by things in which they find no sweetness. If once they fail to find in prayer the satisfaction which their taste required, they would prefer not to return to it. And sometimes they leave it, and other times they continue it unwillingly. And thus, because of this sloth, they abandon the way of perfection, which is the way of the negation of their will and pleasure for God's sake, for the pleasure and sweetness of their own will, which they aim at satisfying in the way rather in this way rather than in the will of God. In other words, they, you know,
the bitters. It's basically the bitters.
it's so perfectly human nature that, you know, I mean, who's going to go with the bitter stuff if they can go with the sweet stuff, you know, and say...
Don't like Brussels sprouts, you know. when I eat a Brussels sprout, I get the chills, so it's bitter to me. I don't want to taste that again. And yet some of these spiritual disciplines, back to that word again, may seem bitter or burdensome or suffering and things of that nature. So... In the reality of what he's saying, this dark night of soul, the search for reality, man has to know himself. And how do you do this? It's because of the outside environments around us. And he talks about, let me pull an excerpt from here. Let's see here. He says that the greatest source of help within man, which is forever available to him and will bring him ultimately security, is the simple and direct emotion of love for God, love for a creator, in the same manner a child would love his parent. So what he's saying is that you can say, oh, yes, I have charity and I have love for all these people. But he's saying we're all one anyway. And in doing all these good things and patting oneself on the back, and the people resent the goodness and the kindness, and people resent people that hit the lottery because they want them to be, if they want to win it. So they're envious of another person who has it. But
the envy of another person's luck or another person's whatever. But you know, this is another thing that's it's in the same section of the spiritual slot. But this is right up what you basically were saying. But it says, many of these would have God will that which they themselves will, and are fretful at having to will that which he wills, and find it repugnant to accommodate their will to that of God.
They call 411, information please, or 911, where are you, God? I need you now.
It happens to them that oftentimes they think that wherein they find not their own will and pleasure is not the will of God, and that, on the other hand, when they themselves find satisfaction, God is satisfied. Thus they measure God by themselves and not themselves by God, acting quite contrarily to that which he himself taught in the gospel, saying that he who should lose his will for his sake, the same should gain it, and he who should desire to gain it, the same should lose it. So in other words, you know,
reverence. That's reverence.
It's reverence. If you're doing it for yourself and to please yourself, then you're not necessarily pleasing God.
Right. He's speaking about reverence, man, a very simple nature.
Right.
The love of deity, the love of God.
That's right, yeah.
And it's a lot of words. He's got paragraphs. He's got books. He talks about Eastern yoga, all the different philosophies. But if you boil it all down, it's adoring the Creator. And the way to find the Creator is through discipline of the inner aspect, seeking inside, knowing that the reality is, the search for reality is that we're all one. We're on one planet, different personalities, different this. And it's hard. It may be difficult for many people who don't research or study or even practice the discipline of love or reverence for what they know they're created to be, whatever name you choose. But again, the only help and the only ever-present guide in a time of trouble is it's natural when someone is in difficulty, they go, oh my God, or they seek God's help when there's difficulty. So even in the simplest form of trouble in one's life, basically the first words out of their mouth is they seek help from some source of the Creator or adoring God. Asking for help, you know.
I love it, yeah, because here he says, let it suffice here to have described these imperfections. I mean, he's talking about spiritual sloth again and gluttony.
That's an amazing, amazing statement. I like the term spiritual sloth, because sloth is one of the deadly sins, by the way.
Yeah, and so is gluttony, which is what he said. And
gluttony, the sloth. He puts it in such a way that it helps us reflect back to how spiritual really are we.
But the spiritual envy and sloth is amazing because he says, in it suffice to have described these imperfections among the many to be found in the lives of those that are in the first state of beginners, so that it may be seen how greatly they need God to set them in the state of proficience. He says, but this he does by bringing them into the dark night whereof we now speak, wherein we wean them from the breast of the sweetness and pleasures and gives them pure aridities and inward darkness, takes from them all of these irrelevances and puerilities, and by very different means causes them to win the virtues. For however assiduously the beginner practices the mortification in himself of all these actions and passions of his, he can never completely succeed, and very far from it, until God shall work it in him passively by means of the purgation of the said night. And of this I would fain speak in some way that may be profitable. May God then be pleased to give me the divine light, and so on and so forth. But he says a line, and then it goes into the dark night. And that's what, you know, no matter how much we try, and by ourselves, no matter how much we want to do good, it's virtually impossible without a divine intervention.
Exactly.
And that divine intervention is the dark night, you know, that comes upon us and gives us the struggle. All right, and creates the humility and the understanding to go on and to understand the cosmic, to understand the wisdom of providence, the ultimate divine knowledge. You know?
Well, that's where man learns by becoming. You learn by becoming. There's a very interesting a spot here that, if I may share this with your listeners, I wrote next to it important, and I guess that's my spiritual ego marking that. So it says, this is a very interesting point because all knowledge indicates man's ignorance. Knowledge is assumed to be given to the ignorant, but as they grow further, they discover the ignorance in the knowledge itself. In other words, the more you know, the less you know. They find that they have not found their answer, and they've become learned, but not for good. They've learned to be strong, but not to love. They found many things, but they have not found God. And St. John points out that when the knowledge becomes great enough, it so increases the confusion of the mind that it's even more difficult to find God because there's so many things out there. So it has that dichotomy, both sides of the coin. But then he goes on to say here that we gain all knowledge by finding God. But again, how do we do this? It's a faith. It's an inner natural aspect. He speaks of the presence of God in all things, as far as the eye can see, as far as you can look out into the universe. The dark night of the soul then is man's gradual discovery of his total dependence should be on the universal spirit which exists within him and around him. This is kind of his answer to the dark night.
Right.
That last paragraph, I think, is very powerful.
Oh, very much so, yeah. And I think where the, you talked about the spiritual ego, and I said, oh, God, one of the...
I'm not exempt either.
I was thinking of myself, and I was thinking of the many times that my ego was contested by a divine providence, if you will, and each time I learned, and each time I laughed because at myself, because I realized, you know, when, especially in writing or when you write or create or do things, you know, when you write something, even if it's a poem or a book or an article or whatever, and you like it and say, geez, that's good, you know. And you, wow, I'm pretty bright doing that, you know. I was smarter, you know what I mean? I can't believe I wrote that, you know. That's pretty good. And then all of a sudden, you know, something. It's unless you realize. I've had instances that where I've actually had, I've actually had auditory hallucinations, if you will, but where I've actually had a voice speak to me, and I could laughing at me, and you know after I pulled that off, and I could hear a voice in my head, and it said. Do you think you're that? Do you think you're really good? And I would go, where did that come from? And I'd say, of course, I'd say, yeah, I do think I'm really good. You know, you wonder, you know.
May I share a story with you, a personal one?
But let me just finish. Then it says to me, do you think I'm better? It just says, do you think I'm better?
And it's your higher mind.
Because I went, you know, I don't know who the hell it is. I don't know what, you know, it's just like a voice from God or whatever, but it made me think of anything of a higher intelligence
right.
than myself saying, you know. You know,
it's quite an awakening. I want to share a similar experience.
Yeah, in other words, it's saying it may be all right, you know, for you, but, you know, there's a whole other world, a whole other dimension, a whole other universe out there who thinks it's, who's laughing at you, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we're still embryos. But the laughter is a great sense.
You never take yourself seriously when you do this.
If you take yourself too seriously, then it definitely is the ego.
The only way that I can adjust everything that I've done ever since then, this was like maybe 10 years ago that this happened to me. And the only way that I've ever been able to do it after since then is because so much of what I do or write or I'll look at and I'll say, I don't remember doing that. Or I don't know how I did that. How I wrote that, you know? And how the hell did I do that? Because I can't write another one like that. You know what I mean? And it made me realize that most of what I'm really doing, I believe that anything good that comes out of me is inspired, divinely inspired in some way, because it's not me, because I don't recognize the work after I've completed it. I understand the work and I see it, but once I'm away from it for 6 months or a year after writing it or a television show or a documentary or a painting or whatever, I'll look at it and I can't believe that I was the one that did that, because I'm going, I don't remember how I did that, you know?
Well, Leah, I always tell myself, I'm not the doer. You know, people will say to me, you know, I'm not really the doer. It's coming.
I just feel like the guy with the fingers, you know, typing the thing. You know what I mean? Or the guy with the eyes and the hand painting it, or you know, filming it, or whatever I'm doing. But whatever that spirit is that's doing it, I give it all credit, because I don't know how. Oftentimes, how I wrote or did whatever it was that I did, when I look back on it and say,
yeah, well, channeling through the higher mind and try not to get pride and ego and all these things, you know, the soul and the truth has to pass safely through pride and ego and as you so well put, the spiritual sloth. I just want to share a similar experience that I had when we first opened up here on Long Island. It was the Ajna Metaphysical Center in Patchogue. I was on the Board of Ethics and had my own column. So it was the first column I wrote, and it was called On Thatness. And I was so elated that it was published. I actually went to sleep with this paper on my chest, and I was so delighted with myself that, you know, I named the place and they put me on the ethics and I wrote my first column, and I'm going back almost 20 years, even more than that,
right.
Way back in the 70s. So I fell asleep with this magazine with my articles on it, and I named the paper and all this stuff. I fell into a state of consciousness that I'm saying, oh, I'm helpful to God. He needs me. You know, this is my thought process. I'm teaching. Oh, my God, I'm actually teaching. You know, these are my ego. I was so excited. And I fall into this consciousness and the spiritual epiphany where I see myself on a ladder, and I'm climbing by myself. I'm climbing up to God because, oh, I'm doing the good work, you know. I'm helping humanity. And in the next instant, there's 100,000 people in front of me and 100,000 people behind me climbing the same ladder.
What a vision that was, yeah.
It was an awakening, let me tell you. So it's similar to what you're saying. Like, I know what I'm doing is divine. I know there's divine intervention. But I laughed at it, you know, and humor is a wonderful, wonderful aspect.
Well, I think what, oh, absolutely, but every time, oh, I just wanted to interrupt for 1 second and say that we have 1 minute remaining of live stream, so we'll continue this for a while, but anybody who wants to call now and continue to listen to our discussion or join the discussion has to call now. The number is 1-646-915-9505. And you can call now, and we'd be happy to put you on. Otherwise, we will be losing the stream in about 1 minute. So
fast. But I had that same experience.
The interesting thing is when you said that is, every time I think of my uniqueness in any way, I think that I realize there are over 7 billion people on the. You know what
to climb on my ladder.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's like I'm going, okay, Leo, your uniqueness is 1 out of 7 billion, you know. And so I think George is on. George, are you on the line?
Yeah, how you doing? Great show tonight.
Oh, do you listen to the whole thing?
Yeah, I caught all but about 5 minutes of it, but that was a great show. Hi, Maria.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, same here. Good to hear you, dear.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, I go back to what we were saying. I mean, whenever I think highly of anything I've done or am doing, I say to myself, you know, there's 7 billion people on the planet, and I am simply one of those 7 billion, right? And it all seems to fall into place. But I love that analogy, that vision you had of the 100,000 going up and the 100,000 behind you.
And I laughed. I just broke out in laughter because the realization was just so profound, you know.
Yeah, anytime we do, you know, you know what I did today to make you laugh? I spent half the day doing promotional stuff for the book, you know, and emailing stuff and going into the social pages and trying to put up my site and put up my books and all this kind of stuff and write little bios and all this kind of stuff on myself. And you know, I was totally exhausted by patting myself on the back, you know what I mean? Because all you do is you just, you know, that's all promotional stuff is. You know, you're just promoting your book, right? You know, you got to get it out there so people know that it's there. And so what I did is I said, you know what I should do? I should put up a page for my on Facebook for to promote the book, a fan page like thing. You know what I mean? That. You know, people can, you know, you can send it to everybody and whatnot. And I got involved for a while in doing that. And I started to, and I said, well, you know, it's one of those pages on Facebook that says, I like, you know.
Yeah, like or just like thumb up or thumb down.
yeah, you know. But what happens is you can put it up and there's no limit to where it can go, and it acts like an advertisement. So it's like a free ad.
Yeah.
But for you or for your book or for your business or whatever. And so I said, wow, you can't beat that, right? Because Facebook, you got 350 million people. You got to reach somebody there. But I started to put this thing up, and I started to look. I said, and it says, you know, I like, you know, L.A. Steel, or I like, I was trying to think of what is it that I like? You know, what am I supposed to like here? So I put up, I did a page called L.A. Steel. I like L.A. Steel. and the radio show and the book, and I had everything included, right? And I look at this thing, and I'm going, and I pressed, and it's, you know, you got to press like, right? So I'm looking at my finished page, and on the bottom it says, Leo Steel likes L.A. Steel. And I'm going, and I left it like that, you know, and I'm going, this is so bizarre, you know, to see myself down there saying, Leo Steel likes L.A. Steel.
And, it fits right into the work tonight.
and then what happened was, is I went to press, and I couldn't figure out how to suggest this thing, and I went to press, like, I was going to send this out to, like, everybody that was on my friends list.
Yes.
And I went to press the suggestion, and it wouldn't take it. It stayed there forever, and it wouldn't send. And I'm going, and it made me look. And I finally canceled the thing, and I took down the page because I kept looking at L.A. Steel. Okay, Leo Steel likes L.A. Steel.
You know,
and it looked so silly, and it looked so lonely there. You know, like I had one friend in the world, and that was me.
but it's okay to like yourself. In fact, you should even worship the yourself because it's all shared. So it's with great humor that you say that.
No, but I get all these things all the time. So I, you know, because some guys, people send them all to me all the time. Like, yeah, I got like 516 likes, you know what I mean, on my info page, you know what I mean?
Neil, like, I've always told you you're a legend in your own mind.
and that clarified it right there.
There you go.
Hey, did you guys get my my chili recipe?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
On Facebook.
I haven't been in the computer for a while.
Well, I tagged you on my chili maxima recipe. So it's sitting somewhere on your profile page.
Okay.
Right?
I made a crab sauce tonight. We went crabbing this week, so.
Oh, geez.
We're getting ready
for
I'm sorry, go ahead, George.
What do you think about this storm coming up your way, Maria?
Yeah, well, I'm prepared. I think we're going to get a lot of winds here, but I'm more concerned about losing the electric because when it gets really windy, you know, we got all these big oak trees around here and the plants on the lines. But I'm not concerned about any flooding or anything like that, but I am prepared.
Well, I heard it just got reduced to a 3. Instead of a 4.
I think it's going to hit Montauk. It's, you know,
Well, that's what they're forecasting. You know, it's going to hit the outer end of Long Island at Montauk Point, then go up and hit the Cape.
It's going to be like a nor'easter for us. We're used to those, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, Leo, I've gone through many hurricanes on Long Island, and I do remember, but no longer will I worry about hurricanes. What I worry about is the tsunami that may erupt, you know, from earthquakes or something, but not hurricanes.
You know, I got to tell you, that humbles us as well, doesn't it? Nature humbles you, holy hell. You stand there like a fool, you know, as trying to fight the strike. You know, you got people staying in their houses, like, we're going to fight this out, and the damn... And you get a wave that crashes and destroys them. You know,
an experience.
Yeah, what about these weathermen that are out there risking their lives to show that the wind is so strong it blows them into the side of the building? Or they have to watch that the ceiling doesn't fall down on them, you know, so they're standing out in the storms, you know, which I know we all need information in this day of information, but... Self-empower like that, I don't know if, you know.
What does it add? I mean, I remember when Al wrote, there was a hurricane not long ago, and he was a year or two ago, and he was standing there, and the hurricane winds were like 100 miles an hour, and it blew him down and crashed him up against the wall.
The one I'm talking about. I think everybody must have seen that 1,000 times.
And Al Roper, you gotta ask, what the hell are they doing out there? Why are they doing it? And the only reason is because
everybody evacuate. But I'm doing something good. there's the charity.
You know,
the charity is his bank account.
The other thing that cracks me up is they send that, like, up here, I don't know if they do the same thing down in your area, but they send out some young, pretty little reporter, okay, and have her standing there in 20 below zero weather in a storm, right?
Right, measuring the snow.
Side of a highway, you know, as the plows are going by and reporting they're alive, you know what I mean? And, you know, as the plows are going by. And you just say, why the hell do they have to be on the side of a highway, you know, in the middle of a nor'easter? This doesn't make any sense. But anyway.
Drama, but it's true. Nature is very humbling. So if nature is so humbling, can you imagine how people feel about the absolute and divine God or creator, as some may call this guidance? So if nature itself is humbling... You
What's
can
your opinion on this? Steve Watkins,
presence of a great being or God.
Steve Watkins, Stephen Watkins, the guy who wrote, came, you know, the English scientist who discovered the black holes. All right. He
Walken?
Walken, yeah.
Walken, not Walken. Hawken.
Walken, right. And he said he came out to
it's
that.
With an H, Hawken. Hawkins.
Hawken. Okay.
H-A-W-K-I-N.
Stephen Hawken, right. He came out today, or yesterday or something, with a statement from his new book that he doesn't believe that God exists because gravity, because of the existence of gravity, everything would have taken place by itself. And his belief is that there is no God. All right. What do you believe in that? I mean, how can you? What's your opinion of that, Maria and George?
Some people don't believe in God. Hey, what's new about that? Nobody.
You know, his opinion of being an atheist, because there are cosmic laws in effect, does not mean there isn't a creator that actually put the cosmic laws into effect. So I do believe in a divine, absolute being.
Yeah, I do too.
Oh, it's a conviction within me. I really have no doubt that,
he's saying there's many universes, and he says that, you know, that
I agree with all that. But what puts it all in motion?
Yeah, right.
Starts with a thought and a sound and a light, thus here we are. You know what it is to be born, what the sperm has to go through just to even be created? So when we talk about our uniqueness without the spiritual sloth, we are unique just in the ability to be in presence and this time. And as George always said, a divine being. As we are, and a human, or a divine being having a human experience having a divine being. How's it
going? That's right. Well, we're sentinel beings having a human experience.
There we go.
Yeah, we're spirits. We flop in and out. But, you know, Maria, a couple weeks from now, Leo and I are going to be interviewing Jeffrey Goodman, who's coming out with a book, a new book, dealing with comets of God. And what he's done is that he's broken down, you know, a lot of the biblical passages, even Revelations, and he talks about, you know, interpreting the great catastrophes that we've experienced, you know, throughout the ages, you know, weather conditions and so forth. And it's quite interesting, you know. He talks about earthquakes and some of the tsunamis that have hit, you know, this earth. But, you know, they rattle big quakes. And, you know, the big quake that I remember reading about, that was in 1700, in fact, the year of 1700s, that it was off the Oregon coast. It caused a ripple, a tsunami, and actually went 7 miles, 700 miles into Japan, where, you know, it... that devastated the whole the landslide.
Well, you know,
and they're able to recover from it. But, you know, he talks about you know, some of the things in the Bible that, you know, we haven't heard the interpretations, you know, like some of the original writings relate to. So it's going to be some interesting times in talking with Jeffrey about this. And I'm really excited in reading his materials and so forth, you know.
Cycles every 26,000 years. The cycles you can find it all through all the biblical things. Even Sodom and Gomorrah, when they said that, you know, fire fell from the sky, they found a Sumerian clay disc that an astronomer had written, and they realized now that an asteroid had hit, and it wasn't, and that's why the pillar of salt, you know, do not turn back, but they were incinerated.
Yeah, yeah. talks about some of the powers of destruction that these asteroids or comets, as you want to call it, you know, have when they come into our atmosphere. And he talks about, you know, the atomic bombs that we have. That's child's play compared to what Mother Nature has.
Well, that's the humbling again, but the thought goes back to why many don't truly believe in perhaps a god or a religious creed of some sort, because even the ancients, they were saying that, you know, that it was a city of sin and this and that, and that's why it was destroyed. But in reality, there was a comet that hit, and it was the ignorance of man. And man never wants to be wrong. Nobody wants to be wrong. But many religions or ideas of God and religions crop up because of simple experiences of not having direct knowledge, or as we, as the soul grows, as our intelligence grows, as our knowledge grows, as I said earlier, what occurs is that some people start moving away from religion in a sense, such as a creator or God, because they see the cosmic laws are in effect. But again, who put them in effect? You know, what animates everything but a supreme aspect or deity? There's the logos, there's the lineage of teachers and knowers and aspects of that nature. But many people fall into the category of science, science. But we're going to find, as we move forward in our progression for humanity and ascension, we're going to find that science and God are one of the same.
Yeah, I think
there you have it.
I believe you're right. And we can almost end on that note, but I wanted to, I hope we can have you back again very soon, Maria.
Oh, I always enjoy it, and it's great to hear from you too, George.
Yes, well, it was great to hear you, dear. I always listen to your note of wisdom, because you have that female persuasion, my dear. And it's much different than mine, but that's not making it any better or any less, other than it's always nice listening to you, because you have a perspective, which is very rare, and I thank my God for that.
Okay,
God,
I'm
going
to have to watch my spiritual ego here now, George.
There you go, yeah. Hey, look, and I'll let you guys get back to what you're doing. God be with you, and I'll be speaking with you shortly.
Thanks, George, and thanks, Leo.
Just say one thing. You do bring a lot of clarity to these very difficult and very complicated issues, and you have a tremendous grasp on it. And George, it's kind of like how you credit Lila for her ability to clarify things.
George,
he's still there. But George is always saying that. But you, Maria, do have that remarkable ability to take a complex subject and make it clear.
Try to simplify it.
I know everybody appreciates that. I love you, and definitely I do.
I appreciate even the opportunity to share that which has been bestowed upon me in this realm. And again, I'm going to watch my spiritual ego over here.
Yeah.
Find a bit ado, and a great night, and hopefully a nice Labor Day weekend, and I'm going to labor with love this weekend, and will honor the self that we all are in sharing in this one planet, and peace inside ourselves perhaps will bring peace to the planet. So with that, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night, Maria. And George, we'll talk to you next week.
Yes, good night.
All right, pal. Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. And I want to thank again Maria Fix Algeri for being with us tonight, and fascinating discussion on mysticism of the dark night of the soul. And the last caller was George Dixon, who's on usually Friday night. He won't be with us tomorrow. We won't have a show, actually, tomorrow night. But George will be joining us next Friday night as Friday Nights with George Dixon. So again, thank you, Maria, for joining us, and thanks. I want to thank everybody for joining us. And again, you can go to that Dark Night of the Soul Book 1 and 2 website. Just look it up, it will be right there. I look up Dark Night of the Soul and works of St. John of the Cross. and you know, hopefully you get something out of it. Fascinating one. And I want to thank everybody again and wish you a pleasant weekend and week, and good night.